And I was speaking with Mike Trenier earlier this week, and he, in reflecting on moving into his new role, said, there's only two concerns as a new leader. One is that people won't follow you, and the other is that they will. And, you know, that would be a little more threatening if I wasn't of the opinion that in many ways leadership is highly overrated. We need to bring it down to the level that when we look around this room, we have an incredible wealth of experience, giftedness. Now, I'm not negating the need for leadership, but just wanting to put it in its proper perspective. I got a little heat for the message title that I threw in here. It's about, and that is, what are you going to do, make it up the morning? Well, you know, it is kind of nice to keep your options open. But I think I'd every opportunity that I have to speak with this gathering, I think I'd probably like to use that message title, because it's really about Jesus. You know, yes, Metro, yes, community, yes, the lost. But if our starting point is not the Lord Jesus, we're going to end up in the wrong place every time. You know, probably many of you heard the story of the little boy in the Sunday school class. And the teacher says, okay, children, what is gray and lives in trees and fuzzy and has a long tail? This little kid in the front row is just so excited. He goes, I know. Okay, Johnny, it's Jesus. And she goes, what makes you say that? You know, he said, well, I know it's a squirrel, but I'm in Sunday school. And so the answer just has to be Jesus if you're in Sunday school. I would like that to be kind of the what comes out of me, regardless of the circumstance, that's our starting point. We've got to have an incredible missional bias to the way we think. But if our missionality is not fused with our spirituality, we're not going to take Metro the place that it needs to be. So this morning, I'd like to talk about an integration of life and ministry, a harmony of spirituality and community and missionality. When you just make it up the morning before, why would you have notes in a notebook? Actually, I will, in the notebook, behind the yellow page, the scripture that we're eventually going to get to is John 17. But the team gave me a mandate that, hey, be relaxed up here. It's not a preach. Just help people get to know you. Well, I want to do that, but I also want to preach. And then I have an exercise I want to get us to. So I'll just talk fast, and we'll get there together. And if we need to, I do not want to cheat our prayer time. If we need to, I'll borrow a little time out of the affinity groups, and we'll just move things back just a little. Last words are very important. In Deuteronomy 31, verses 8 and 9, Moses' last words to Joshua, "The Lord is the one who goes ahead of you. He will be with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed." The promise is ahead of them. The mandate is there. The promised land. Moses is no longer there. And what is it that Moses' parting words are? But the Lord is with you. It's about Jesus. Now, there's a task that you are clearly called to, but don't ever venture to go there without God. Now, I think that was probably pretty clear to Joshua with the magnitude of what was ahead of him. But I don't think it's always clear to us, because it's too easy to lower our sights on what we're called to do. One of the things that God did to really prepare me to say yes to Alan to move into this role was the last time we were together as Metro leaders, we had John Ed share some things about his life and his experience in France. And he was daring enough to use the F word in front of all of us. Many times over, he talked about failure. And as I listened to John Ed, I thought, he risked much in going to France and paying the price that he did. And he set his goals high. And there was always that feeling of, did I really accomplish what I came there to do? And as we broke up into small groups to process some of that in prayer that day, I thought, I don't relate deeply to the word failure as I look back on my life. There aren't many experiences that I would go, you really got sideways here and did not get it done. And I thought, that's not something to brag about. Were your goals set high enough in the midst of that? And the word that God spoke into the context of that was risk. What are you willing to risk? Yesterday when we prayed, Bob Phobes prayed that the Lord would give us courage and take us into new places of risk. Last night at the banquet, I sat with Ron Nussbaum, talked about establishing factory relationships in Bangladesh and Mozambique and Mexico and multiple countries around the world. And he said, it's all about risk management, but you've got to take the risk. It's not about management. Metro is not about management. If it is, we're dead in the water. If there isn't something that has the potential of failure in front of every one of us, both individually and corporately, we're not going to need this challenge that it's all about Jesus, that it's the Lord your God who goes before you. I'm beginning to sermonize a little bit here, but 1 Corinthians 28, verse 9, a verse that's familiar to many of us. It's David's last words to Samuel related to the building of the temple. He says, as for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will let you find him. But if you forsake him, he will reject you forever. Now, this God-centered exhortation that Moses gave to Joshua and that David gave to Solomon was in the context of mission. Take the promised land, build the temple, lead the people. I love the fact that Mike's last words to us were significant. The thing that's really on his heart, the thing that will really carry Metro into the future, is spiritual generations. Well, there's a risk attached to that. In a Christianized America, big is better. And we will be misunderstood if we are committed to this vision of starting small, planting the gospel, and believing that God will grow it. Well, tracking with last words, John chapter 17. They aren't Jesus' very last words, and John 17, the text in the New Living Translation, is in the notebook there for you. But before I get into John 17, and I'm not going to do a deep exegesis of it, I'd just like to drop back a little bit and describe some of the shaping influences in my life that have brought me to where I am today. I'm a small town Pennsylvania boy. Grew up in a religious home, but one without Christ. A lot of love and security in that setting. I left home when I was 17 to come to the Air Force Academy. It was a God thing that I got that appointment. My best friend applied for that appointment. He was valedictorian. He was a football player. He was class president. And teachers said to me, to my face, how in the world did you ever get that appointment instead of Denny? It just, well, I didn't know it then, but it was God. It was about Jesus. Because probably less than 10 miles from here where I stand right now, straight line out into the Black Forest, is a camp where I met Christ my freshman year. Led to Christ by a lay laborer, one who was next door to everywhere, a skinny Air Force captain named Jerry White. And the foundations had been laid for me. I believe the Bible was the Word of God. I believe Jesus was the Son of God. I just didn't have a clue what that meant. Other than that, I was a very spiritual person. And it was kind of the best of the navigators, what I got in on at that point in time. Came to Christ, an upperclassman at the academy, followed me up. But it was typical navigator reality of that day. And being in a high leadership profile environment, the discipline, the demands of the academy, it's much different than Annapolis. It's a real military school. And,
who won this
year? Oh, I deserve that. I'll own it. I was actually in the stands weeping. So, a year. Okay, it's time to take the gloves off. For those of you unacquainted with this strange and wonderful relationship, this is an ongoing thing. In fact, I'll buy John Ed lunch and we'll watch a little bit of the Air Force or the Army-Navy game. So, I was a year into my walk with Christ. Jerry was called back to Purdue to get his PhD, and a mild-mannered pastoral gentleman named Leroy Imes took over the ministry at the academy from a distance. Leroy was just fresh out of the experience where his nickname was Nails. And I still remember a message that he preached that was so in line with everything we believed and everything we gave ourselves to my senior year at the academy. It was about how to make an impact on an area for Christ. And three things. You've got to be wholehearted, you've got to be single-minded, and you've got to have a fighting spirit. Well, that the missionality of all that just fed into the ethos of the academy setting. And there was a lot that was incredibly good about it. Now, quite fortunately, when the Air Force puts a couple $100,000 into educating you, you have a little payback time. So 5 years of my life as an indentured slave was now, you know, pierce the ear to the doorpost kind of thing. I was not really around the navigators for the next 5 years, which was a very healthy thing for me. If I had an opportunity to go on staff at that point to begin to train, that's the direction I would have gone. But being out there on my own brought me to a place of Christ dependence. There weren't a lot of methods being passed my way. That was a very, very valuable time of my life. In fact, about the only time the navigators appeared on the scene, it was to kind of try and mess things up. I'd gone to Vietnam, was flying combat missions when I was 22 years old. Again, kind of a shaping influence. This pilot mystique, you know, it's flying is really highly overrated. You don't need to really fly the airplane well, because people just see you get in the airplane, take off, see you land, you get out. They don't know how you fly while you're out there. You just have to look good. You know, if you have a little Tom Cruise swagger and that whole thing, if you, you know, leave your sunglasses on when you come in, you know, it just, that's all there is to it. There's not a lot of skill associated with the thing. But when I came back from Vietnam, I was an instructor pilot in Oklahoma, and that's where the insider dynamic that you talked about, Dan, there was nothing else to it. I mean, you just lived for Christ. You were surrounded by guys who did not expect you for a minute to have a spiritual focus to your life. And when you flew together, played together, lived together, and then shared Christ, it was the most natural thing. And then it just spread relationally in that context. But the regional director at that time showed up to look in on things there, and he said, "Are you doing evangelism in the dorms?" I said, "Why would I do that?" He said, "Well, that's what we're called to do. We're apostles." I thought, okay. And then, of course, when he left, I just went back to doing what I knew God had called me to do. It was a very easy thing. But these kind of things, God began to nibble away at some of this independent, self-sufficient spirit that was part of the environment that I grew up in. And obviously, the thing that really takes that to where it needs to be is when you get married. Get married and have three daughters right off the bat, and you deal with tears and screams. And I thought, let's see, Leroy never told me about this. You know, I didn't face a lot of this at the academy. And in fact, spiritual gifts test, we've all taken them. When I take a spiritual gifts test, invariably tongues comes out as a higher gift than mercy. And I have yet to speak in tongues. You know, this task drivenness. Doug and I were with a brother even a few weeks ago who really began to pour out some deep wounds in his family situation. And I was there with an agenda. And I kind of related to his wound a little bit, and then I went on with my agenda. And finally Doug said, "You know, I think we ought to stop and pray." I thought, boy, am I glad for a team dynamic where we really bring our giftedness to bear. That's leadership. Mercy is expressed in leadership when it steps up and expresses itself at the need of the moment. Well, Linda and I launched off into 18 wonderful years of college ministry. Took a work at Oregon State University. The fellow who preceded us had a big group, but he really didn't have the giftedness to develop leaders in that context. And so it's like the raw material was all there. We just hit the ground running and had an absolute blast. Went from there to develop the Collegiate Works in Southern California. And again, this was pretty much a very easily fruitful time in collegiate ministry. We just multiplied from campus to campus. It was just a rich shaping experience. But at the same time, it was very evangelical in character. There was this just the overall environment of Christendom. Even though we were very evangelistic in what we did, it was always the lost. God was preparing us to really see things in a whole new light. And that largely began when Linda and I took a group of couples to Poland in the summer of 1991. We decided, I'd been teaching an adult fellowship in a large flagship evangelical church for 10 years, 100 couples, just the kind of thing that at that point in Christendom experience, you go, yeah, that's good stuff. The only thing was, it was not an environment that would ever lead to the advance of the gospel. And I was just beginning to grasp the depth of that. And the Poland experience, particularly with one of the couples we took, began to launch a new chapter into things. And I've asked Linda if she would come up and pick up a few things at that point. And before you do, how about if you share just a little bit about our family?
We have four kids. They aren't kids anymore. The youngest is 19. He mentioned three girls. Then Fred got a son. An unplanned son. Amy is the oldest. Amy and Sarah were here last night, so some of you met them. They are located in Denver. We moved 3 years ago to Denver, and they are there also, which is really fun. Amy is a teacher, seventh grade language arts. She's gotten a master's in England. Fred took Amy and Sarah to Russia when they were in high school, and it began this love of travel and exploration of the world. And so whenever they get a chance, they do that. So Amy is a teacher. Sarah is graduated in business, found out quickly that she hated life in the cubicle. And so she's done a lot of different things and presently just got back from a raft trip down the Grand Canyon. She just likes to work hard, save her money, and then go off on an adventure. So anyway, they're in Denver. Hannah is on Edge Corps at the University of Arizona. Just began in August, and all three of our girls went to university at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo because we lived in California when they all started. Hannah's having quite a time, great time. We just got to visit her earlier in November, and she's learning vocational ministry isn't all just having fun with students on campus, doing the downside stuff is new to her, but she's doing great. And Daniel, we moved when Daniel was 16, took him out of where he had at. We'd actually not quite lived in that house his whole life, but he was the only kid born in California. And it was very difficult. So as soon as possible, he moved right back to California, reestablished residency, and is in junior college back in the town where he grew up. It's been a very good growing thing for him. You know, he's just about to finish his first semester of community college, so we'll see. Anyway, we have a lot of fun as a family and look forward to Christmas together and stuff. So, did I say enough about them? Okay, Fred asked me to talk about our community in California. What happened? Right before, there were four couples of us that went, right, from Fullerton. Oh, well, I guess there were more, but four that we were connected with a lot. But one of the couples, just before we left on this mission trip, the wife got together with me and said, "We are getting trained to move into a Polish home and help them." Americans were very attractive to Polish people. So a Christian couple would have one of us, like we lived with a family, and they would say, "We have Americans with us. Would you like to come over?" So we were a natural way for them to reach out to their relatives and friends because people were intrigued by Americans. So we were being trained on how to do that in the Polish culture. And Tammy said to me, "I want to do that here. I don't want to just go to Poland and do it for 2 weeks. I want to do it here. Will you help me?" And she said, "I want to have a Bible discussion and I'd like you to lead it." And I said, "Okay, I'll think about that. When do you want to do it?" "Well, I've sent out the invitations, and it's starting Wednesday or something like that." And so I did it. Daniel had just turned six, and I'd pretty much done everything in my house, but I felt like I could venture out. And I mean, not that I didn't ever leave my house, but I didn't commit myself to weekly things that would go on for a period of time. It was quite the adventure. She is hospitality, gather people. Everybody just is attracted to her. They just gather in her house, the kind of person that Henry, you said yesterday, you know, when there's a party, they all go to their house. And I'm so not like that. But I could make friends with these people that she knew and sit in a living room and lead a discussion group on the Bible. And over a period of about, was it 3 years? So many women came to know the Lord. It was, and I, at the very beginning, I had heard, I was thinking a lot about the gospel, and I was thinking about how unfair it was that I really cared about lost people and didn't have the gift of evangelism. I just didn't get why that was so hard, you know. And so I'd heard Donald McGilchrist talk about center set, and I said, I just want one thing. I just want us to say that you and I want to walk toward Jesus, and we don't care if you know more than us or less than us, or but we just want, if you want to go that way, just come to this discussion. And it's like we aren't talking about lines, crossing lines. Did you ever cross this line, or would you cross this line today? Or we just said, could we do this a new way? And it was amazing to be in a team, to see women trust Christ and get alive and excited. And Tammy had another baby, and one of the key women moved to Northern California where we were meeting, and it was starting to fall apart. And then Fred and Tim, our two husbands, were getting to know some of the husbands and boyfriends and stuff. And so we ended up meeting, we said, let's just meet all together, men and women. So then the guys kind of took the leadership, and it just sort of evolved. But we were also concerned about our kids, because we went to this huge, huge mega church, and we were concerned about their view of church. We had strong convictions that church is really important, but we weren't sure that what the programs that they were being exposed to was what that meant, what was really important. So we called this group that met every other Sunday afternoon Family Church. And we just said, we want our kids to know that church is the people of God. And that's really important in your life. But maybe going to meetings is not always that connection with the people of God that is what Jesus wants for you. And, let's see, what else was I going to say? We decided we wouldn't grow by adding Christians. We had the Cahills, that's Tim and Tammy, the women's study. And then we had added one Christian in there, Lana, because I felt like when I met her, I felt like she had such a heart for God, and she had a lot of non-Christian friends and really cared about them. I guess that's what I always looked for. And was really young and still connected. And so Lana had joined in with our women's study. So when we started, it was Glenn and Lana, Tim and Tammy, Fred and me. And then other Christians go, whoa, we hear what you're doing with your kids. Could we come? And Fred said, no, but we'll help you start something like it. We'll do anything we can to facilitate this. But we totally grew by interested non-Christians whose relationships with us got to the point where they wanted to hang out. Or we had parties. We'd have Christmas parties. We'd have camping trips. Memorial weekend, we'd go on a 4-day camping trip. A lot of people became our friends. Like one family's friends would become everybody's friends by camping together. And maybe Fred will tell you some of the individual stories. It's really humbling and exciting to see that I could be me and people would come to Jesus without the gift of evangelism. You know? Fred made a list once. About 25 people came to Christ during those years. I don't know how many years. And as I said in our little group yesterday, the place where the gospel continues to advance are not so much the Christians, although to a small extent, but the one where the generations are happening are the people who came to know the Lord in that. They just can't imagine it being any other way. And they know church is not it's relationships and it's community. So that's where it still continues to flow with us gone. Fred, we always had three goals. To love God, love one another, and love the lost, or encourage each other to love the lost. But the thing I remember, Fred, we kind of had these. Fred would say, evangelism is a.
It's a team sport.
We would say a team sport, and evangelism is.
A process, not an event,
and a work of the Holy Spirit. So we just kept saying that a lot to each other. It's a team sport, so you've got a friend, a neighbor, bring one of these guys from Family Church and do something together, you know. And so those were great years. Fred was traveling to Russia a lot as this was happening, so it wasn't our main ministry. And then when co-mission ended, it was the same thing was going on with Don and Matt and that bunch, and we saw the fit, and so that's how we got in community ministry.
Why don't you share about your present insidership, just how God's freed you to be you and what that looks like?
Well, we moved 3 years ago to Denver, and we've been influenced by Mike Shamey and Jim Peterson. And I also have to say, Lee Brace and the prayer ministry, and in England, the Celtic community there. So I would say that God was doing a lot to help me be a more God-focused person and giving me a passion to live as an insider. So those two things were big, shaping. I could tell this is big, shaping thing in me. But then we moved, and I had a fresh start of what am I going to do, you know? And I just decided I wasn't going to make friends with Christians. I mean, you know, I've always, you know, we'd go to church. We know how to do the church thing. We know how to join this, get in a small group. Pretty soon we'd be asked to lead, da-da-da, you know. We'd be appreciated, maybe even supported, you know. But we moved right before 9/11, and the churches became full, and then they became empty. And so we would go in and say, what if we just lost a parent and we're just checking this out? Let's see what it feels like to just walk into church and see, or a child, you know, we're really hurting and we're going to look in. And we would just go. And everybody had their friends, and we looked at church from being an outsider. And yeah. And we would just, and then every church we go to started a building program, and we thought, you know, no wonder people on our block don't want to have anything to do, you know. And so we moved into an incredible neighborhood that's very community. The women go out to dinner once a month and have parties. We have block parties on one end of the street, block parties, and we're in the middle, so we get invited to both. And then the first neighbor who came over to visit us said, do any of you play tennis? There's a real active tennis community here in Stonegate. And both Fred and I love to play tennis. And I hadn't played a whole lot during the years I was raising my kids. And I had just started again the year before we moved back. So I promptly broke my wrist, so I couldn't do that right away. But I kept in touch with these, you know, these people. And then in the spring of our first year there, it was my left wrist, so it was okay. So I joined a tennis league, and I got to know a bunch of people. And just because I love tennis, because it's really me, it's not like I'm being fake. It's really fun. And I've made a bunch of friends. And I broke another bone last December and was out of it for 6 months. And I really thought God was taking it away, because this time it was my right elbow. And I thought, okay, whatever. You know, there are those shirts that say, you know, tennis is my life. Well, I thought, okay, I'm just going to give it up. But I can play again, miraculously, kind of. And so I just do everything I can to hang out with these women. And I just try to say yes anytime anybody calls me to play. And I play in a league. And I'm starting to learn how to spend time with these women, these very busy moms and that is to drive places with them. You know, drive to the indoor tennis courts or drive to a round robin, something. And then we get good conversations. And I'm not very aggressive. Or I feel like I could use any of your ideas on how to pursue this incredible, I mean, you know, number of people that I know now that are just a few are getting a little bit deeper, and I'm just trying to be aware of what God's doing. And I do have like two or three friends on the street that are getting a little deeper, and it's really, really fun. It's a whole big adventure for me, and I sense it's very right for right now.
Well, the beautiful thing about it, it's who Linda is. It's not who anybody else is. It's who Linda is. And that the friendships that God is giving in the midst of this are genuine friendships. These women provided as much, if not more, support for her when she broke her elbow last December than anybody in the Christian community, because it's a genuine relational setting. This is my favorite insider. I'm going to ride on her coattails. I have relationships with a number of these husbands, and we've spent some weekends together with folks. It just takes time, but we're committed not to dropping into the religious community, but engaging with these folks. We believe, give us a little time, and we will have a living room gathering that is mixed of young believers and seekers that are in the scriptures together. Thanks, babe.
Can I read something?
Oh, sure.
I read this. I'm reading this little booklet by Henry Drummond, who lived in the 1800s, called City Without a Church. And I really like this. This is what I'm trying to do, and this is what I would say to you. He says, teach Christ not as a doctrine, but as a discovery, as your own discovery. Live your own discovery. And that's what I say. Do that. That's what I'm trying to do.
This was not just a little cameo to get to know Linda. She's a woman who has a lot to say. And I want to represent to all of us here that one of our most underutilized resources is our wives. They have been left on the bench. They have been underdeveloped. They've been under-resourced. And I just encourage everyone here. Women, take that initiative. Get out from behind the kitchen counter and be on the front edge of this thing with us. Because wives are the social glue that God has designed to hold society together. And the relational, God-given relational nature of women is key to where we want to go in Metro, in seeing the gospel follow natural, relational, and family lines. Well, as Linda mentioned, commission for 5 years gave me a natural exiting point from this adult fellowship of 100 couples that I'd taught for nearly 10 years. I needed an excuse, or it would have been pretty offensive to just say, you stay here, we're going someplace else. God gave us those couples to go with us out of that setting. And I stayed in good touch with the pastor as we began to plant things outside the walls of the church. I'd say, Dale, here's what we're doing. I'd like you to keep a check on my ecclesiology. He said, that's a good idea. I said, would you be willing to return the favor and let me keep a check on your ecclesiology? Maybe. So it's pretty hard to live with that question when you're the pastor of a 5,000 mega church that has a wonderful reputation. Let's transition to John 17. And like I said, it's in your notebook in the New Living Translation. Again, we're back to this issue of final words. These are not Jesus' final words. Obviously, post-resurrection, we get the Great Commission. But the thing that's special about John 17 is the way it is Jesus' dialogue with the Father that I think gives us tremendous insights into this integrated model of life and ministry that he would have us follow. I'll just overview that real quickly. Three spheres. Think of it in terms of three spheres. The inner sphere is the life of Jesus within me. That sphere is encompassed by a broader sphere, me in community. And that communal sphere is encompassed even more broadly by that community in the world. Very simple, but I think, particularly in the text of John 17, is something that is very easily communicatable to those that we labor with. Jesus in me. Let me just read verses 13 through 26. Follow along and you might even highlight anything that stands out. Jesus says, "Now I'm coming to you. I have told them many things while I was with them, so they would be filled with my joy. I have given them your word, and the world hates them, because they do not belong to the world, just as I do not. I'm not asking you to take them out of the world, but to keep them safe from the evil one. They are not part of this world any more than I am. Make them pure and holy by teaching them your words of truth. As you sent me into the world, I am sending them into the world, and I give myself entirely to you, so that they also might be entirely yours. I am praying not only for these disciples, but also for all who will ever believe in me because of their testimony. My prayer for all of them is that they will be one, just as you and I are one, Father, that just as you are in me and I am in you, so they will be in us, and the world will believe you sent me. I have given them the glory you gave me, so that they may be one as we are. I in them, and you in me, all being perfected into one. Then the world will know that you sent me and will understand that you love them as much as you love me. Father, I want these whom you've given me to be with me, so that they can see my glory. You gave me the glory because you loved me even before the world began. O righteous Father, the world doesn't know you, but I do. And these disciples know you sent me, and I have revealed you to them and will keep on revealing you. I will do this so that your love for me may be in them, and I in them." Jesus in me, verse 23. I in them and you in me. I in them again, the very last three words of the chapter, verse 26. I in them. The grand mystery of the first incarnation and now the mystery of the indwelling. God in me. It's about Jesus. Ever wish that you could have walked with Jesus, you know, Birkenstocks, dusty feet, roads of Galilee, actually hear his voice, witness the miracles? You know, I've had to come to grips with the fact that my experience as a disciple with the indwelling Holy Spirit can be every bit as real and authentic and powerful as what those 12 encountered. And I mean, that's John 14:16. Where Jesus says, you know, I will give you another comforter who will be with you. That word for another, there are two Greek words for another. One is heteros and another is allos. Heteros is, you know, the prefix heterosexual. It's another of a different kind. Allos, which is the word used in John 14, is another of the same kind. Jesus very intentionally chose allos in speaking to the disciples about the Holy Spirit. And then he follows that up in verse 17. He says, "This is the one who has been with you and will be in you." The very Jesus who walked the roads of Galilee with the 12 is the one who indwells us in the form of the Holy Spirit. Although tongues is higher than mercy, I long to be a more charismatic person. You know, I long to know the reality of the Holy Spirit. I long to be so in touch with what he says and an unswerving obedience to what he says. That's what I long for us in Metro. that we would be known as a group of Spirit-led men and women who really respond both to what God is saying to us personally and to what He's saying to us missionally. In my years in the desert without the navigators as a pilot, Andrew Murray became one of my patron saints. And I just couldn't go by without quoting him from Waiting on God. He says, "The whole duty and blessedness of waiting on God has its roots in this, that He is such a blessed being, full to overflowing of goodness and power and life and joy, that we, however wretched, cannot for any time come into contact with Him without that life and power secretly beginning to enter into us and blessing us. God is love. That is the only and all-sufficient warrant of our expectations. God's love is just this, His delight to impart Himself and His blessedness to His children." It's about Jesus. Jesus in me, me in community. I took the liberty to actually underline these so because there was a lot of text in starting up in verse 11 with that dotted line, the end of the verse, that they will be united just as we are. In verse 21, they will be one. And again, just as you and I are one. Verse 22, they may be one as we are. And again in verse 23, all being perfected into one. You know, that this passage at one time in my life turned me off because it was used ecumenically, and what it did was distorted the dynamic of the calling that I felt was on my life, that I had to lay down my calling in order to be one with all these other Christians around me. It was not an accurate understanding of things. But when Linda and I began to experience biblical community in the context of this missional setting, taking the gospel to the lost, I thought, I have missed this. You know, I'm beginning to value it. I mean, my phrase used to be like the wag that said, to dwell with God, to dwell above with the God I love, that will be a glory. To dwell below with saints I know, now that's a different story. You know, it just, for me, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book on life together, again, was very shaping. And the words that the exclusion of the weak is the death of community. Because I could not deal with my own weakness from my background, I was not willing to allow others to be weak in that setting either. You know, it's been a wonderfully freeing thing to understand that we really do need one another. In all likelihood, that is why West Pointers make better Christians than Air Force Academy graduates. You've got a platoon. You've got a squad. Whereas in the Air Force, it's you in the airplane and the bad guys down below. It's a one-man deal. That is not the Christian life. It's about us in Jesus individually, and it's about a community of grace. Now, again, I think one of my reactions against community was the fact that it was community often represented isolated from the world. So it's Jesus in me, me in community, but that community in the world. Verse 15, I'm not asking you to take them out of the world. Verse 18, I am sending them into the world. Verse 23, then the world will know. That is such a beautiful progression. I love it. I love this passage. I love the integration of it all. That life and ministry, community and ministry, are not distinct things. But this is God, the triune God, who models these very things. This is what we're called to. That is why I have included Alan's papers in the notebook. At the end of the section, there, in Alan's paper on the navigators and church in the American context, on page two, if all you do is embrace one phrase, and you really don't need to go there, you can go there later. The end of page two, he talks about new wineskins with new relevance to the new context. Now, I realize in an African-American setting or in an Hispanic Catholic setting that it's going to be different, that there needs to be new relevance, but you don't need to change that whole context. You are called to minister within the context of that Catholic Church. But for many of us in evangelicalism, we need to come face to face with the reality that particularly if we're going to minister to the next generation, it's about new wineskins with new relevance for a new context. I won't even go into Alan's paper on missional communities because I'd like to take us through just a little exercise real quickly. Okay, this side of the room versus this side of the room. This side, you are navigators. You are traditional navigators. This side of the church, this side of the room, you are local church. Okay, now there are strengths and weaknesses for both of you. So we're going to do a little taste great, less filling kind of thing. Let's get into that. Okay. Taste great.
Less filling. Taste great. Less filling.
Oh, man, this is a hard thing to do in the morning. Okay, I'll just help you guys out. Something that characterizes you, for starters, the Great Commission. Okay? Come back with something little that the church may hold on to. Okay? Worship. Great commandment. Oh, yeah. Great commission. Worship. Okay. What's another thing that characterizes you guys?
Good vision.
Mission?
I said vision.
Vision. Teaching. If you can, stack these up against one another. What's another thing that characterizes you guys?
Commitment.
Commitment.
Yeah.
Guido, how many times have I told you about that? Okay, give us another one.
Investment.
Okay, let's come over here and you guys come up with one that you think is a good thing that characterizes you.
Longevity.
Okay.
Mobility.
I heard discipleship over here. What do you want?
Full service.
Full service and fellowship. Okay. Because I knew time would be limited on this, went ahead and, in fact, on the is it a tan sheet in there? There are two columns. Actually, three columns. One that says mission, one that says community, and then one that says missional community. Right after John 17. I had to alter that a bit, and I called it the navigators versus the local body, like this little exercise. And I went ahead and I made a list contrasting the Great Commission and the Great Commandment. We're apostles. We're task-centered. The church is, you find, not apostles, but pastor teachers, and the focus is the flock. For the navigators, needs or weaknesses. For the church, needs are central. The navigators, it's a go-to, the lost. For the body, if they're focused on the lost, it's attractional. We're about traditionally a gospel presentation. Here it's a gospel invitation. Discipleship versus fellowship. Equippers versus teachers. Multiplication versus addition. Now, this is not true of every setting, but for the sake of saying, there are things that we can learn from the local body about community in many settings that we have traditionally missed. And there are things that we would like to offer that are good about who we traditionally have been as navigators. How would we synthesize some of these things in a way that would look like missional community? How do we bring these together?
The Great Commission via the Great Commandment.
Okay. You're actually ahead of me, Connelly. When we get down here to the highest goal at the bottom, I think that's where I think you're right on track when we talk about the glory of God. That, again, it's not about the mission alone. It's not about community alone, but it's the glory of God revealed in the context of both. Dean talked about love being the avenue that takes us to the lost. Grab another one.
Is the next one on the apostles' task? Wouldn't our those are both gifts within the body? Wouldn't our missional communities also then want to reflect the gifts of the body? Both sides.
We want to reflect both of them, but is there a way to bring them together? You know, not just...
That's what the body does.
The type of leadership that we want to move toward, how would you characterize a type of leadership? Instead of apostolic leadership alone, or a pastor-teacher type of leadership alone, what kind of leadership... If you were launching a missional community,
entrepreneurial.
That entrepreneurial is pretty apostolic in character. We want it to be apostolic.
Keep it
team. Yeah. Team. Gift based. Where do needs fit in? I mean, if we're going to be missional, how do we embrace needs at the same time?
Would you define what you mean by needs?
You mean I have to be vulnerable in front of everybody?
You know,
well, it's just like, okay, I have needs. I have a son who's just been expelled from high school because of marijuana use. Or my marriage is struggling. What historically... As navigators, how have we dealt with those kind of issues?
You'll get involved with church.
Go get help and come back when you're
healed. Okay. When you're healed. In fact, we've been known for shooting our wounded because everybody's got needs. I mean, in fact, needs are a reality. It's not that they're central. It's not that they're a weakness. They just are. Yes. Yes. That's the. Well, I don't have room, but I agree with you 100%. Yeah. Oh, that's a very good way to say it, Andre. Empathetic ministry is the way Andre said it.
Needs are a way to actually demonstrate love.
Good. Chris.
Your alliteration, the first line at the top right would be the great confession. Lord, I don't see people the way you see them. Help me to love the lost.
That's good. it's too crowded, but I agree with you.
Years ago, I remember being in conversations where we talked about task versus heart. But I think that dichotomizes in the wrong direction. Our task is heart. Mm. We have a relation. We have a task that is love. I mean, that's the task. So how do we divide those things? You can't.
Yeah.
It's all about love. It's all about relationships.
That's where we're really moving. What we see in the midst of this is what I've been talking about all the way along, is the integration of this whole thing. It's life. Let's just drop down. Instead of a gospel presentation or a come to gospel invitation.
Gospel
incarnation.
I think that's a good word. We don't want to abandon discipleship, but we don't want to swing over to lukewarm fellowship. What's...
How about doing discipleship with fellowship?
Okay.
How about maturing?
How about maturity?
Community. Transformation.
Oh, that's a good word. Community. Transformation. Instead of... our old navigator multiplication or the church's dynamic of addition, what are we looking for?
Math. Exponential.
Differential equation.
It's gotten so complex.
Generation. Talk to Don on that one, would you? Just. I don't feel like we need to press to conclusion on this kind of thing, but I wanted to just create a few mental images that this is the way we assess our current realities, some of the things that are still a part of who we are, and yet we not be reactional against what we don't want to be, but we define ourselves by who we're becoming as a missional community. Jesus within us, us in community, and that community in the world. Just in wrapping up, verse 19. I gave it a double underline here in John 17. Jesus says, I give myself entirely to you, so that they also might be entirely yours. Oz Guinness, in his book, The Call, says, our primary calling as apostles of Christ is by Him, to Him, and for Him. First and foremost, we are called to someone, God, not to something such as motherhood, politics, teaching, metro, or to somewhere, such as the inner city or Outer Mongolia or Minneapolis. Our secondary calling, considering who God is as sovereign, is that everyone, everywhere, and in everything should think, speak, live, and act entirely for Him. It's about Jesus. And that, if we are to expect the quality of life that will carry the gospel into a lost and broken world, I think, for me personally, I am challenged to give myself entirely to Him so that they might be entirely His as well.